3RPH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many-faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 13.
With some diffidence, I turned to the other side, the attitude of the seeing toward the blind. And I am obliged to say here, it is hard to get away from the pack psychology. That is, the tendency to say and do things at times which indicate what a load the physically sound are apt to regard the unfit. I cannot say that I have experienced it often, yet I have come up against this instinct which wants to exclude and leave behind the weaker members of the flock. I recall the contempt in the tones of that woman who told me that I was mistaken if I thought her son would marry a blind girl. I found this spirit operating to keep me out of my appointment in the education department, without even a trial. Now and then it creeps from its lair to thrust a dirty paw into social relations, when awkward conduct puts you at a disadvantage. Sometimes you know an acquaintance walks past without offering a salute, with the mental reservation, she won't know, as she doesn't see. I struck it again on a certain occasion when an interviewer called on me. He had been informed that although blind, I wrote verse, and he asked to see something. I brought out my books, and after examining them, he explained, "But this is real work, good poetry. I didn't think you could do this sort of thing. I just supposed you were kind of, well, you know, a rhymer." "Just so," I said, and I doubt whether he perceived the sarcasm in my answer. I knew it was the pack psychology once more, but he did not. So much rudeness of this kind is quite unintentional. I suppose it is difficult for a person with full sight to imagine how one without it can do anything. Yet it is a matter of history that the blind, through the centuries, have contributed much more than their quota to the culture of mankind. It seems extraordinary that a reporter should forget Homer and Ossian, Milton and Blacklock, and the host of less-known blind minstrels who wandered the world with their harps in the Middle Ages and kept alive both the arts of music and poetry. And there are Huber, the bee scientist, Metcalfe, the engineer, Sanderson, the mathematician, Prescott, the historian, Fawcett, the parliamentarian, and many other illustrious names, all blind men who gave to their generation gifts worthy of their best pair of eyes. Nevertheless, though I have written these comments on the pack psychology, I know the heart of the public is in the right place. When I recall my own experiences and the good that has been my portion through all the years, it is easy to believe that the leaven of Christ's teaching has worked, and I love my fellows in spite of occasional tactlessness, and I feel that they love me. The same is true of my comrades. They are happy and forgetful of their loss, the best of them continually striving to live independently, to realize the ideals of citizenship, even to the extent of setting their mark on the thought of their generation. The economic problem is ever present for the sightless, since avenues of employment have been limited hitherto, and the earning capacity is reduced in many cases when work is available. Then there are many little services which the seeing can perform for themselves, but for which the blind feel obliged to offer compensation, and this further reduces their income. Places could be found for us in general industry, but here again the pack complex shows itself. One time I was on a committee which was trying to get placements for blind workers in factories among the seeing, and we interviewed a certain labour leader on the question. His reply was, "Oh no, that'd never do. The other workers would object. They would feel that we were cheapening their jobs by putting a blind man on." The exigencies of war have changed that a little for the time being, and the sightless toiler is proving that he can undertake similar work to that of the sighted and make the pace hot as well. Such incidents as the above could hardly fail to beat the spirits down, if the blind would let them, that is, but they refuse to drop into an inferiority complex. In fact, sometimes they arrive at the other extreme. But that is better for them and their friends. The battle is good and a stimulus to achieve and conquer. Beyond question, the great aim of both blind and seeing should be to reach mutual understanding, and this can be done in all cases, save those who have a preeminent distaste for intercourse with the physically defective. I have met a few people of this description, and with them I could make no headway. I cannot quite fathom this psychology, unless, once more, it is attributable to the pack instinct. It is definite, however, and the individuals who have this feeling do not hesitate to show it. They say it makes them miserable to meet afflicted people. If that is all, it is the result of crass ignorance or ridiculous self-pity. God be thanked that the vast majority of men and women have got above it, and human hearts warm rather with mercy and with the joy of helping to salvage for the community such as have been robbed of their full usefulness by such a handicap as blindness. There is one other aspect in which reference may be made with advantage. This is the subject of compensation, so often introduced in little discourses of a would-be comforting type. Many folk imagine that when vision fails, there is a sudden and miraculous increase in the other senses. They sigh and say, "Ah, well, if God takes one thing, he gives another." Once a dear lady got confused in her effort to comfort me and put it backwards. "If God gives one thing, he takes away another." Of course, I understood and got the comfort and a smile as well. Let it be remembered, however, that there is only one way of compensation for any deficiency, and that is the great basic principle of life, that powers which are exercised grow and increase. It is the gospel story of the talents. Faculties are doubled by their application to tasks. So, when the avenues of sight are closed, there is a natural effort to make up the need with the hearing, touch, and smell, and possibly with the development of unknown powers within us, which are called into play without our knowledge or perception. We call it instinct in the lower animals, but I truly believe it is the outcome of cultivating sense channels, which we have in common with them. Thus, whenever I come up against the miracle of compensation in the mind of my good friends, I merely remind myself, if not them, that our chief readjustments to take place through our own hard work and endeavour. Further literary work. As soon as I had managed to launch Songs of Light, and having regard to the literary pension which had been bestowed upon me by the nation, I set to work to prepare other matter for publication. First, I rewrote a story which had been conceived before, dealing with the child life of any such country town as my native Carisbrook, and this tale I named Gold from Old Diggings. I rather hoped it would appeal to some of the old boys and girls who, like myself, had spent their early days in a rural setting. I excuse this juvenile picture by remembering that Mark Twain offered the world his Tom Sawyer and Booth Tarkington his Penrod Papers. So I got the typescript in trim and sent it to Mr. Stevens of the Bendigo Advertiser. His response was immediate. He wrote that he had started on the typed sheets immediately after dinner and had not put them down until he had finished every page. He had been bred among the gold mines and old diggings and knew the life I had depicted through his own personal experience. So he accepted my story for his paper, and it appeared as a serial, beginning in August 1937. Mr. Stevens had been very friendly to me on many occasions, giving my work more than usual publicity, and for that, as well as for other reasons, I did not ask for any financial reward. In fact, I was, and am still, so anxious to give back to the community something to justify my pension that I was glad to have Gold from the Diggings published in a paper which would reach so many people likely to appreciate this special kind of book. In that region may be found many who spent their school days within the sound of mine whistles and clanging pumps, and who roamed the bush and climbed the mullock heaps in search of adventure, and I have some cause to think that they might read the tale with pleasure. It is possible that some readers who knew old Carisbrook may have recognized in Hithy Polglaze my brother Steve, The boy in the story was modelled on the recollection of my brother, who was a genuine young bushman and a decidedly enterprising adventurer in his boyhood haunts. As with all my books, I enjoyed writing it, and I have not given up hope that it will find yet a wider public than on its first appearance. On the completion of this task, I set about arranging a series of pictures of the derelict men and women left by the receding tide of the gold rushes in almost every district where the feverish search for the precious metal had lured the hopeful crowds of diggers, good and bad alike. Around Carisbrook, we had our share of those honoured and unpitied souls. Odd old characters who passed gently through my post-infancy periods. Some of them were wont to come to my father's bootmaking shop, either for business or a pure and candid gossip. Others inhabited lonely huts in the bush, from which they sallied forth at such times as money matters would permit, a few days' spree at the local public houses. They worked a little for the farmers, or fossicked in the gullies for scraps of gold, and so kept body and soul together, while they lived and died aimlessly. Thinking of them, I had planned a little picture gallery, when I tried to exhibit in kindly words not exactly the poor old deadbeats of my native place, but quaint, unusual people who should be representative of their type everywhere. I believe I succeeded in this, for many readers have asked me if I were writing of Yakandanda, White Hills, Friarstown, and many other widely separated centres where I have never visited, and of which I knew nothing more than their names. One gentleman, in a phone conversation, asked me if it came from Wangaratta, for, said he, I recognised every one of the old beggars as former residents of the locality. But the fact was, I did not know Wangaratta, nor its people, as I had merely passed through the town en route to other destinations. Thus, no special place is the actual scene of my tales of old-timers, as written in the book of that name. In due time, the book was ready, and I took it to the Lothian Publishing Company. I had called it Deadbeats and Derelicts, but the publisher thought this would be a bad selling title, and suggested that I think of another. I'm glad this change was made, for after all, my choice was a harsh name for the tales, and that was the last thing I desired. Since my attitude towards such broken, such luckless and unfriended beings is one of tolerance and kindly sympathy, in the end, the book became Old Timers, and under that name it went to the press. Mr. Arthur Greening, at the time manager for Lothian, also suggested that I should find some well-known literary man to write a foreword for the sketches. I approached Mr. Alec H. Chisholm, at that time editor of the Argus. Now it happened that Mr. Chisholm and I had had some friendly exchanges by post, for we were born but a few miles from each other, loved the same bush country, and found the same exhilaration in the glory of the springtime wattle bloom, on the low stony ranges about our first earthly home. Without hesitation, he acceded to my request, and his most valuable introductory note was a part of Old Timers when it was at last printed. But the financing again proved a snag. I had hoped for easier terms on a second book, but the publisher was willing to take no risk. Once more, therefore, I stood behind my brainchild, gathering in my orders in advance. Let me assure you, it requires a lot of faith in oneself to tackle this kind of job time after time, and the most discouraging elements in it all was that the publisher was unable to sell my books to any extent. However, it did appear through Lothian in Melbourne and through Hodge & Son in London in the year 1938. The press notices were again quite good, and encouraging criticisms came from many competent to make them. Enough copies were soon sold to meet the cost, and from time to time the books have drifted out until there are a mere dozen or two that have not gone into circulation. It is a great satisfaction to me to know that I have again contributed something to the culture of the community. For this little volume had captured a phase of our Australian life which will soon be lost for ever, now that our old-timers are, with few exceptions, nothing but memories. This book brought us yet another pleasure. It put me in touch with Mr. and Mrs. Chisholm. Quite a different experience from reading his wonderful books on our bird life and exchanging a few letters about our mutual tastes in country scenes. My last venture in publication was a small collection of my more recent lyrics under the title of The Inner Garden. This went into circulation at Christmas 1940 and was intended as a seasonable greeting to my friends and acquaintances. I paid the whole cost myself and ventured to print a surplus for which there was a ready sale. If I can judge my own work, I should say that in this small collection appears my most finished verse. It was beautifully produced by the Hawthorne Press and favourably received by the critics. The edition was small, only 550, and it gave a margin of profit as large as might be expected on such a limited business venture. In addition to the few pounds I made, it gave me yet another opportunity of reaching the public and of realising my desire to serve in return for my pension. I wonder if any who read this candid story of my literary efforts will smile and say, "She set herself at a high price." They will think of all in terms of vanity and perhaps marvel that I persisted. Well, they will have to forgive me, though I should like to remind them that the same kind of vanity was the stimulus of many great men who have adorned the realms of culture in literature, art, science, and philosophy through the ages. All of us know that the final verdict lies with time, and those whose work is worthless will pass away with their generation, even if they seem to shine then. Like every struggling author, I have written much that has not been published. This includes more than one novel, many poems, stories, and articles, all safely housed at the present time in my dovecot for homing pigeons. Possibly none will ever see the printing press, but I am glad for the few which have done so, chiefly on account of the delightful contacts that they have brought me, and of the sense of achievement which they have afforded. Perhaps the most important note of appreciation I possess concerning my literary work is an inscription written in a presentation copy of his great book, Adam Lindsay Gordon, Life and Best Poems of the Poet of Australia, Westminster Abbey Memorial Edition by Douglas Sladen, author and critic. Last Tasmanian visit. As mentioned in another place, I have spent many delightful holidays in Tasmania, where I had some dear friends living, more recently at Birches Bay, down the South Channel. It was there that I found rest and beauty among the apple orchards and along the quiet roads, or perhaps on the sheltered beaches facing Bruny Island, across the lisping waters of the Channel. But the most memorable visit I made to the island was one I enjoyed just before the outbreak of the present war. My nephew, Fred Ault, and his wife invited me to their home in Hobart, and as they could take full charge of me during my stay, I decided to make the journey alone and to travel by plane. I had not been in the air before, and longed to have that experience, for only once, and here was my opportunity. I wondered if riding in a plane would have any thrill for me, and was most interested to find that it had. Swinging out from Essendon, I felt the turning about, the tug upwards, and then the steady, smooth sweep onwards. I was definitely excited when tea was brought to me, and I ate it, perhaps a couple of miles above blue and shining Bass Strait. Next I got out my small pocket tablet for writing Braille and dotted out some brief messages on cards which were to be posted to friends, explaining to them how lofty I felt sailing through the air so far above the level of earth crawlers. Stopping for 15 minutes at Western Junction Airfield, we came down at Cambridge near Hobart, right on time, and there Fred and family met me with the car and drove me on to the city by way of the ferry, and to their historic old house on the Domain. This was the beginning of a fortnight of such happy whirl as I have rarely passed through. An interview by phone with the social editress of the Mercury came in 10 minutes after my arrival, and this announcement of my presence brought around me a host of friends, both old and new. How good to me were my dear kinsfolk! Their car, with daughter Lillian as driver, ran me hither and thither to attend functions, or to keep appointments with some acquaintance or other. They took me to the top of Mount Wellington, and while I stood with my hand on the flagpole, a flurry of snow swept over, my very first meeting with the snow, since I have never before chanced to be at a place when it fell. I gave a broadcast one morning, and months afterwards heard that some friends at Lavers Hill near Apollo Bay in Victoria had listened to it. My niece and I attended an At Home to Lady Gowry, given by the Mayoress of Hobart, and there I met some delightful women, every one of whom was a special worker in some field of public philanthropic service. The blind folk also made me welcome at a social gathering in their club room, and the late Colonel Payne, manager of the Institution for the Blind and Deaf, gave me the opportunity of making a thorough inspection of the school. Another day, I had a very interesting chat with Mr. Dwyer Gray, the State Treasurer. Previously, he had given me some publicity in his paper, The Voice, particularly on account of my literary work, and my interest in the special uses of the senses by blind people. Now he took the chance to continue that discussion and made many inquiries about the work for the blind in Victoria. I need not say that I was glad to answer him in full. A highlight of my visit was the renewal of my acquaintance with Dr. Doris Miller at the time, Vice-Chancellor of the Hobart University. He had been a fellow member of the Moonee Ponds Literary and Debating Society when we were both reaching out after mental improvement and cultural attainments. So he arranged a little morning party with me and my hostess, when we could chat over old times, recall many friends of former days, and traverse again the arguments that had furnished the bludgeons of our immature judgments of youth. It was pleasant, too, to exchange particulars of the life of each during the time which had elapsed since our last meeting, and specially interesting was it, to me, to learn that he had been devoting much of his time and ability to the cause of the blind in this state. Hobart was in a festive mood at the time of my visit, not because of my august presence, of course, but to celebrate the centenary of the Hobart Regatta. The old house, which my relatives occupied on the domain, had been built by convicts in the early days as a residence for some of the officers. It stood near Government House, and its substantial walls had faced the winds and snows of many a winter right on the slope above the harbour. From its upstairs windows could be seen the wide stretch of the Derwent, its boats and yachts and skimming ferries, and just below us the flagship, there for the carnival and fun of the hour. Each morning I would arise and dress to the tune of Waltzing Matilda, played by the band on the flagship as the breakfast serenade, and it became a regular joke that I should be thus saluted as I began my day. In addition, we often enjoyed a fine band concert from the same quarter, mellowed by the distance and the balmy February airs, and made richer by the echoing hills about the harbour. Twice during my stay, we had a picnic farther afield. On one occasion, we took the road up the Derwent Valley, recalling my visit to the Wilsons at Mount Nassau, right on the roadside a mile or two from Bridgewater. The garden still smiled across to the river steamers from the front of the house, and there was the lime kiln where Mr. Wilson had taken me to open up the kiln after a big burning of the stone. But the trip I shall ever best remember took us down the peninsula and on to the terrible Port Arthur of hideous repute in the younger years of this settlement of Hobart. I should like to forget what happened there, but history cannot be blotted out. There are some who would like to wipe away this stain by obliterating the relics left in the stones of prison and chapel. But should we forget how depraved man can become when started down the road of cruelty and sadism? Rather, is it not necessary to preserve such memorials as a warning to us of our weakness when we grasp power over our fellows? Let me not dwell on these horrors, but turn to the natural wonders to be seen in this remote region of our southern isle. First come to the blowholes. On the day I stood beside those tremendous phenomena, the weather was moderate, but up through the main pit raged and roared the spouting sea, filling me with awe and nervous shrinking as I leaned against the barrier that restrains the rash sightseer from too close an approach. Down in the gulf, every time an ocean wave assaulted the shore from the wide Pacific, the gush of water would roll and rattle loose stones and hiss like a dragon against the gruesome walls. On a stormy day, the scene must be terrific, and the noise appalling, and the fate of a human being who chanced to fall in there would be left in no doubt. Down on the beach, we walked on the tessellated pavement, one of the world's wonders in the realm of nature, since its pattern, unlike similar phenomena in other parts of the earth, has its stratification in squares. Up on the neck once more, I could hear the murmur of the tides on both sides, the South Pacific on one hand and Storm Bay on the other. But from these miracles of creation, we must tear ourselves away, and in the cool of the evening, we glided northwards towards our home, past the timbered hills, under the shadows of bird-thronged trees, and over the ferry to the busy city once more.
And that brings us to the end of episode 13 of The Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pam Adams. This series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.